This is Audible.
Podium Publishing presents Deathmarked, Book 4 of the Fatemarked Epic, written by David Estes, performed by Derek Perkins. The story so far. In Fatemarked. The Hundred Years' War has stretched over a century, ravaging the nations of the Four Kingdoms. Before the war began, a prophecy was made by a woman now known as the Western Oracle. The prophecy, which promised the coming of the Fatemarked, who would bring peace to the lands, has been forgotten by many, while others believe it to be naught but a legend. Still, the truth of the ancient words has begun to come to pass, as there are those being born with strange markings that grant the bearers unusual powers. In some lands, the marked are revered, in others hated, even put to death. One of the Fatemarked, the King's Bane, has his own prophecy, to bring death to 8 rulers across the 4 kingdoms, which will usher in a time of peace. His work has already begun. 3 rulers have been killed in swift succession. King Wulfric Geric, known as the Dread King of the North, King Gil Loren of the West, and King Oran Ironclad, the Juggernaut of the East, have all fallen. But Bane's task is far from finished, and now he plans to turn his attention to the south. Little is known of what has been transpiring in the southern empires of Calip and Fanes, except that the 2 nations have been embroiled in a civil war caused by the marriage dissolution of the 2 main sovereigns, Empress Sun Sands and Emperor Vin Hosa. In the kingdoms, however, time has marched ever onwards. To the west, with the death of King Gil Loren at the hand of the King's Bane, his eldest nephew, Jove Loren, attempts to usurp the throne from the true heir, Princess Rhea Loren. To accomplish this, Rhea is charged by the Furia with breaking her vow of purity with a common thief known as Grease Jolly, an alias for his true name, Grey Aris. As punishment, a W for whore is carved on her face, leaving permanent scars. In her mind, her greatest attribute, her beauty, has been stripped from her, leaving her with nothing left but revenge. When her horror and sadness turn to white-hot anger, she murders her cousin Jove and reclaims her crown, vowing next to win the war and defeat her enemies on all sides. Meanwhile, Grey Aris's sister, Shae Aris, who is fate-marked, is abducted by the Furia and taken south to a chain of islands called the Dead Isles, which are rumoured to be haunted. Grey, charged with thievery, has his hand cut off as punishment, but manages to escape Night's End with some help from Rhea. Grey follows the Furia, eventually hiring onto a ship the Jewel, which is headed south. His goal? Find his sister and rescue her. To the north. After Bane murders the Dread King, the crown shifts to Archer Geric. However, before he can claim it, his uncle, Lord Griswold, swoops in, accusing he and his mother, Sabria Loren, of conspiring to kill the king. The eldest of the king's heirs, Anis, feels powerless as she watches the execution of her mother. When Archer is brought to be executed, however, the executioner suddenly makes himself known as a famous warrior known as the Armored Knight. They escape through the sewers along with another knight, Sir Dietrich. While they travel to the southern part of the realm, Anis realizes she has turned 18 and now has the primary claim on the throne. She refuses to tell her brother, though she confides in the Armored Knight, who turns out to be her long-lost friend from childhood, Terin Shiri, believed to be dead, but now cursed by the witch's potion that saved his life. They also meet up with their eccentric aunt, Lady Zelda, who reveals that the King's Bane is actually their younger brother, who was smuggled from the north immediately after birth. When the Easterners attack Raiders Pass, Archer is knocked unconscious by the King's Bane, his own brother, who turns up to try to kill Anis, who is now the lawful Queen of the North. However, Sir Dietrich manages to fight Bane off, showcasing his uncanny skills with the blade. Bane, exhausted from the ordeal, vanishes. Anis and the others seize victory from the east, killing King Ironclad and others. Now, with Anis having declared herself the true queen, and with Archer comatose, The Garricks and their allies are marching north toward Castle Hill to reclaim the throne from the usurper, Lord Griswold. To the east. When a young man named Roan, who grew up in Calypso, contracts the plague from a mysterious beggar on the street, he's sent to quarantine on an island called Dragon's Breath. There he reveals his own fate mark, called the Life Mark, which allows him to heal himself and escape the island, which is guarded by two-headed dragons. Fateful currents pull him to the east, where a chance meeting makes him the prisoner of Prince Gareth Ironclad, who immediately brings him to Ironwood and the eastern capital of Feria, the Iron City, where humans live in harmony with the Aurians, a mystical people who can channel the ore that lies beneath the forest. With the help of one of the Aurians, a fate-marked named Gwendolyn Storm, King Ironclad swiftly learns of Roan's marking and forces him into helping their armies as they march on Raiders Pass to exact revenge on the North for the killing of the Queen. Roan reluctantly agrees, and soon learns that the East has another of the fate-marked, a mighty warrior named Bjorn Stonesledge, the Iron-marked. Roan also discovers that, as the firstborn son, Gareth is the Shield, which means his life is forfeit, to be given to protect the second-born son, Guy, the true heir to the Eastern throne. Along the way, Roan begins to grow close to both Gwen and Gareth. At Raiders Pass, the North defeats them, killing King Ironclad, Prince Guy Ironclad, and injuring Bjorn Stonesledge. Gareth Ironclad is nearly killed by the King's Bane as he tries to protect Guy, but Roan saves him by using his life mark. In the aftermath of defeat, Gwendolyn Storm realizes who Roan really is. Roan Loren, Prince of the West and true heir to the Western Kingdom. She helps him escape, and together they slip away, crossing the border between nations and into the Tangle, the largest western forest, known to be almost impassable. In Truthmarked. To the north. While her brother Archer continues his slumber, Queen Anice Garrick leads her forces against Castle Hill. Before they reach their destination, they encounter a knight, Sir Metz, who has just come from the castle. He brings tidings of an army of monsters, created from men by an elixir contrived by Lord Griswold's potion master, Darkspell. Though the news shakes Anice, she refuses to back down from the fight. During the battle, the monsters are killed one by one, but not without a heavy toll. Anice loses almost her entire army, including Lady Zelda's husband, Sir Craig. However, they do make one ally during the bloodbath, Sir Jonius, in the form of a monstrous bear who, by sheer will of heart, manages to maintain control and switches sides, helping them achieve victory, killing the Ice Lord and Lord Griswold, both of whom are monsters themselves. Taryn Sheeri, the armored knight, also survives, but is overcome by his bloodlust. Fearing he might be capable of harming Anice, he sneaks away while she is held captive by her queenly duties. With her army annihilated and having learned that her uncle had lost the rest of the northern forces in the Bay of Bounty, Anice knows the north is ripe for invasion. Sir Jonius comes forward with a map only recently discovered. The map shows the location of an ancient group of mighty warriors known as the Sleeping Knights, who, as legend tells, will awaken in the north's time of need. Anice immediately begins making plans to lead a small expedition into the hinterlands to locate these knights, who may be the North's only hope. To the west. Queen Rhea Loren, much to the chagrin of her cousin and advisor Ennis Loren, enlists the help of a man known as the Summoner, long considered to be a practitioner of old magic forbidden by their deity, Roth. When the Northern Armada sails out from Blackstone, Rhea commands him to summon an ancient monster of the deep called Rathos. He does, and is killed a moment later, but not before Rathos obliterates the Northern ships, leaving none alive. During the melee, Ennis disobeys a direct command from his sovereign, saving Rhea rather than the summoner. With no other choice, Rhea charges Ennis with treason and plans his execution. In the end, however, her conscience makes a reappearance and she fakes his death, giving him a disguise and false name in her guard. Meanwhile, in the Tangle, Roan and Gwen struggle to navigate through the insufferable forest. Soon they are joined by Gareth Ironclad, who tracks them after fleeing the east as the failed shield. Together they overcome an unexpected attack by a wood nymph queen, who tries to enslave Roan and Gareth. Gwen saves them with help from a half-man, half-bear, who calls himself Bear Blackboots, and then disappears. Eventually they reach Night's End, where Roan decides to take a risk and reveal himself to his sister. Rhea swiftly betrays him, imprisoning Gwen and Gareth. Gareth tries to commit suicide so he can't be ransomed to the east, but Roan saves his life yet again. When Roan and Rhea uncover information that implies either the Western Oracle or her son might still be alive, she forces him to go south, to the Calypsian city of Citadel, to bring them back in chains. If he doesn't, she promises to kill Gwendolyn Storm. To the south. In Calypso, the beggar who infected Roan allows himself to be captured by the Empress, Sun Sands, but is then pushed into her by Bane, who shows up unexpectedly. She dies of the plague, Bane's fourth kill under the prophecy. The Calypsian throne is fought for by two of her daughters, Raven and Fire, but it is Fire, one of the Fate-marked, who emerges with the Empire. She immediately plans a mission to Fane's to attack the Southron gates, taking most of her elite warriors, the Guanero, led by Goggin. They cross the desert, stopping only in the oasis of Kesh, where Fire is nearly assassinated. From there they ford the spear, marching on the gates, managing to melt two of the four massive doors before Phoenician forces repel them. Fire is killed, her body exploding in a firestorm that incinerates the remaining enemies and lights the tangle far to the north on fire. The unburning tree finally burns to ash. Raven Sands becomes Empress without challenge from her youngest sister, Whisper, who is heartbroken by the death of her mother and sister. Raven learns it was the Easterners that plotted to assassinate Fire at Kesh, and she immediately begins considering revenge. In Fane's, Jai Jaru is a slave master bearing the Justice Mark. He is intent on freeing his slaves in Garadia Mine and helping them escape across the border. His opportunity comes when the mine is attacked by a group of rebels known as the Black Tears. They are led by Sonika Vaid, although it is another of them, Shanti Parthena Lord, who Jai becomes closest with. Together, they lead 5,000 slaves across the arid wasteland, barely surviving an attack from a feared Red Pison, before reaching the Southron gates at the same moment as the attack by the Calypsians. Simultaneously, the beggar, who has been befriended by Bane, appears before Jai. Bane has charged him with spreading the plague in Fane's to eradicate any warmongers. However, the beggar refuses, remembering who he once was, a boy named Chavos. Instead, he stabs himself in the gut, though Bane manages to save him. In the confusion, Jai, the Black Tears, and the surviving slaves breach the wall and emerge into Western territory, free at last. However, in a horrifying twist of fate, one of the slaves, an ex-master named Axa, betrays them with a magic mirror, which allows the Emperor, Vinhosa, who bears the slave mark, to re-enslave them all. They are brought back to Garadia, where Jai, along with most of the Black Tears, is now a slave in the very mine he once controlled. Shanti, however, is taken to Fenir to slave away in the palace. Jai is in despair until Bane kills Emperor Hosa, thus releasing every slave across Fane's from his magic. In Solmarkt. To the north. When Anise Garrick heads north in search of the legendary Sleeping Knights, she meets one of the Fate-marked, Lisbeth Lorne, who bears the soul mark, a blue eye that allows her to see the deepest parts of the souls around her. With Lisbeth's help, Anise manages to locate, awaken, and free the Sleeping Knights from their slumber, giving the kingdom the army they so desperately need. Meanwhile, Taryn Shiri travels with the renowned blacksmith Fay to Darin to defend against an eastern invasion. He expects to find a stalwart force of war-hardened soldiers, but those left are the dregs, a craven group drinking themselves into oblivion. Taryn strives to prepare them for what is to come, all the while fighting his own demons. In Castle Hill, Sir Christoph Metz is training the newly established Queen's army, but when he hears of the plight in Darin, he leads an all-female force across the frozen wasteland. The East finally attacks, with an army led by Bjorn Stonesledge, the Ironmarked, but is repelled by Taryn Shiri's defenders, until help can arrive in the form of Anise's sleeping knights and Sermetz's smaller but determined force. Bjorn Stonesledge is killed. However, after the battle, Anise learns that her stronghold at Castle Hill has been taken by an infamous band of sellswords known as the Brotherhood, who have captured Lady Zelda. To the west, Rhea Loren, inspired by her own pregnancy, reunites with her younger siblings Bea and Leo, finally releasing them from prison. However, when she learns of a plot by Bea to overthrow her, Rhea strives to teach them a lesson by summoning Rathos and scaring them into obedience. She loses control of the sea monster, and it devours Bea while she and Leo stare on in horror. At the same time, Rhea's cousin Ennis secretly tries to help the prisoners, Gwendolyn Storm and Gareth Ironclad, escape to prevent the poison master Darkspell from releasing a plague that will wipe out the Aurians. Ennis is captured and banished to Fanes, while Gwen and Gareth make for the border river, the Spear. At the Spear, they find Darkspell at the river's edge, about to spill his potion into the water supply. They are too late. But then Rhea, in a change of heart, kills the potion master. She returns to Night's End, determined to make peace with her eastern and northern neighbors, turning her military attention to the southern slavers in Fanes. To the south. In the Burning Sea, Grey Aris and his sister, Shay, sail on the Jewel toward Pirate's Peril, where they hope to uncover the truth of Shay's mysterious connection to the Pirate King from her dreams. As they approach the island, they are attacked by treacherous sea vampires called Drachma, but manage to survive the attack, though there are numerous casualties. The pirates capture them, and they finally meet the Pirate King, Eric Clawborn. He also bears a marking, a half-mark, which completes Shay's marking. Before they can explore their power further, the Drachma attack the island. Their combined forces manage to defeat the vicious sea creatures, driving them back into the ocean. In the aftermath, Shay and Eric learn that they have the power to either destroy all the fate-marked, including themselves, or further strengthen the fate-marked of their choosing. They decide the latter, and the pirates set sail for Fanes. In Fanes, a rebellion is brewing, with the Black Tears, Jai Jaru, and Shanti Parthena Lord at its core. They seek to overthrow the Hoser brothers, until Shanti learns that the new emperor, Falcon Hoser, is not a bad man. Jai also discovers a slave army, 10,000 strong, trained from birth to fight for the Empire and none else. The efforts of the rebellion come to a head when Falcon's brothers, Fang and Fox, challenge him for the Empire. In the ultimate betrayal, Fang kills Fox and then poisons Falcon. Just before Fang kills Falcon, Jai uses his justice mark to take control of the slave army and kill Fang. The slavers are overthrown, the slaves liberated, leaving the Empire in a time of upheaval. In Calypso, Rhone Loren makes his way to Citadel, where he begins to study under the supervision of the scholar, Lady Windy Sands. His goal? Learn of the origins of the Fate-Marked and their purpose. Simultaneously, the new Empress, Raven Sands, seeks to fight off the Easterners, who continue to attack the Calypsian borders under the command of King Gryon Ironclad. Angered, she agrees to a dragon attack on their capital, Feria, in the heart of Ironwood. Rhone tries to dissuade Raven of this course of action, and at the last moment she calls off the war. However, several of her dragon masters rebel, attacking Raven and her allies, and flying for Feria. Her royal soldiers, the Guanero, are killed, but Raven manages to survive. When she tries again to stop the attack, she watches as the ore-based Ferian defences wipe out all her dragons, their masters, and her soldiers. To the east. While the Calypsian assault continues, the King's Bane appears. The Deathmarked One has had his own problems. Poisoned by his friend and ally, Shavos the Plague-Marked, he is weakened but not defeated. He pretends to try to kill Gareth Ironclad to gain the attention of Rhone Loren, but both Raven and Rhone intervene. Bane manages to use his power to transport Raven back to Calypso, where she is taken captive by her aunt, Lady Viper, who has usurped the throne in her absence. Bane also transports Rhone to a place of darkness and silence, where he tries to convince the peacemaker to join him. Rhone rejects him, however, and goes back to Citadel to continue his studies, where he learns the answers he seeks are in the decimated nation of Tarragon. Angry and alone once more, Bane decides the only path to peace is for the four kingdoms to be united under one ruler. Him. And now, the story continues. Prelude. Crimea, circa 532. The Horde. He didn't enjoy the taste of blood. Not the way they did. And yet there was a measure of satisfaction in seeing it spilt so easily, crimson puddles darkening as twilight fell like a scythe across the most powerful nation in the world. It was a prelude of things to come, practice for the grand event. "Vengeance will be mine," he thought, as he strode amongst the carnage. Ruined buildings, once grand and fine, now laid low by fire and hammer. Bodies adorned in the finest silks and leathers, now torn and shredded, soaked in death and ash. Beautiful beasts of war, magnificent horses and the famed Mongol beasts with their thick legs, flat heads and curved spikes protruding from their snouts. Dead. Broken. Fallen like all the others before them. The Horde was a force of nature, as powerful and unstoppable as a giant wave roiling across the ocean. "And I will crash on the four kingdoms," he thought. "Oh, yes, I shall crash, and they will burn." In their tongue, he was known as Kla Gra, Sun Geric. Others called him the Lost Sun. Part 1. Roan, Zelda, Anise. Christoph, Taryn, Lisbeth, Rhea, Gareth, Gwendolyn, Ciri. In life we fought, we raged, we conquered worlds without measure. In death we met the truth with upraised chins, our jaws set. In the eternities, that's where we loved. Japati, famous Calypsian poet. 1. The Southern Empire, Citadel, circa 532. Rhone Lorraine. He awoke with a start, the dream fading into the orange light flickering around him. Strangely, the smell of death, melting copper, burning tar, lingered on the tip of his nose. That single word pounded in time with his beating heart. "Horde, horde, horde."
"I don't understand,"
Rhone whispered, closing his eyes. Thankfully, the images were gone, sucked back into the void from whence they'd come.
"And that, my young acolyte, is music to a scholar's ears,"
a familiar voice said. Rhone's eyes flashed open, to find a face bearing a whimsical expression peering down at him. The woman's hair was a tangled bird's nest, her skin the colour of molasses, gilded with honey from the flickering wall sconces affixed to each wall. Windy Sands, the eccentric but shrewd aunt to Raven Sands. She was the master of Citadel, the Calypsian city renowned for its archives, the largest collection of knowledge in all the four kingdoms.
What?
He said, trying to sit up. The room spun, the heaped piles of books and disjointed baskets of scrolls spiraling like the wings of a falling bird. Windy reached out and collected him under the arms, her spindly fingers stronger than they looked, as she laid him down gently. Something soft caught him in a warm embrace, a mattress and two fluffy pillows.
"Slowly," she said, "you've been unconscious for almost 2 days. You've had nothing but drips of water to sustain you."
2 days? Rhone strained to remember how he'd arrived back in Citadel. Images appeared, one at a time at first, and then pouring forth like the waters behind a released dam. The mutiny against Empress Raven Sands. The dragon attack on the eastern stronghold at Feria. Bane. What had the dark bearer of the Deathmark said to him?
No,
Rhone thought. It wasn't what he had said, it was what he had shown him. That glimpse into the past, where the Oracle and her son, Bear Blackboots, had been transcribing her visions.
In the beginning there shall be death, and there shall be light, and there shall be two sides of the same coin.
No,
Roan said aloud, still trying to refute the truth that had been laid bare.
It cannot be. I am nothing like Bane. I am a different coin. He lied to me, or twisted the truth to suit his purposes.
What cannot be?
Windy asked. Roan's eyes snapped to meet hers. For a moment, lost in the memory, he'd forgotten she was there. He remembered something else. It was Bane who had given him the gift that allowed him to return to Citadel. Bane had wanted him to return to that dark place with no beginning or end, the place where time seemed to stand still, an eternity held back by nothing but will and shadows.
I,
he said, but then stopped.
Raven, where is your niece? Bane took her when my dear sister Viper usurped the throne while Raven was being betrayed by her own dragon masters.
What?
It's true.
Windy spun a lock of wispy hair around one finger.
Even I underestimated my sister's wiles. Evidently she's been building an army of criminals from the fighting pits of Zoon.
Roan shook his head, trying to make sense of the senseless.
What will happen to Raven? To her sister, Whisper? Viper has held a grudge against Sun and her daughters for many years. She will not be kind to them.
But what will she?
I don't know.
It was the first time Roan had ever seen the Keeper of the Archives lose her temper. Windy refused to meet his eyes.
We have to help them, Roan said.
Even as he said it, helplessness seemed to push in from all sides. Every step he took forward seemed to drive him back a dozen paces. He remembered what he'd been told time and time again. Peace is impossible. The Four Kingdoms do not want peace. Even his closest friends, Gwen and Gareth, had told him this. Hell, his own sister, Rhea Loren, wanted to wage war on three fronts at once. Windy's eyes snapped back to his.
And what of the fate of the Four Kingdoms? Would you watch it burn while you save the lives of a mere two players?
There are no players, no pieces to be moved, Roan said. This isn't some game.
Exactly. This is real. And our lands sit on the edge of a knife. On one side is peace, and on the other war. Or we may be torn in two.
Windy paused, but Roan could tell she wasn't finished.
Unless we do something first.
Roan let that thought sit for a moment in the silence. It was so close to his own thoughts over the last few weeks that it couldn't be coincidence. He was meant to be in this place at this time. The winds of fate and the strength of his own two feet and Bane's unexpected gift had brought him here, whether for good or ill. Something Windy had said broke loose in his mind.
Thank you for quenching my thirst while I slept.
Windy's eyes narrowed slightly, but then widened.
It is not me you should thank, but Yila. She rarely left your side. She squeezed the sponge that dripped the water between your lips.
Yila, Roan remembered. The girl he'd once believed to be dead, murdered at the hands of his guardian, Markin Swansea. As it turned out, Markin had faked her death to threaten Roan into never using the power of his life mark again, at least not publicly. Now Yila and her brother, Darris, were scholars under the tutelage of Lady Windy Sands herself.
Please thank her for me, Roan said, feeling an odd electric sensation buzz through him at the thought of Yila's silky dark hair brushing his cheeks as she leaned over him,
pushing a finger between his lips to open them to receive each drop of water.
You can thank her yourself, Windy said. She's standing just behind me.
Roan snapped away from his thoughts, feeling heat on his cheeks. Yila peered around Windy's bony shoulder, offering a quick wave. The heat left his cheeks quickly when his eyes met hers. Her eyes were pools of night-dark water, speckled with starlight.
Despite having only truly known her a few days, she felt like a dear friend already. There was something about the quiet time they spent seeking knowledge together that felt intimate. Roan brushed away the thought. "Thank you," he said. Her eyes never left his. "It was nothing." She hurried on, as if anxious to depart the topic. "I've been poring over these manuscripts, and I've discovered at least a dozen references to the death of absence." "Yila," Windy said, cutting her off sharply. The girl clamped her mouth shut, a sheepish look crossing her face. "Apologies. I tend to get ahead of myself." "Absence," Roan said. The word sounded familiar in this context. "You mean the Terran god?" Yila looked to Windy for approval before answering. The lady sighed, but then offered a nod. A smile creased Yila's lips, and Roan found himself smiling too. There was something about her delight in the pursuit of knowledge that was contagious. "Absence was the Terran god for many years. In Terragon, the people would travel hundreds of leagues to gaze upon the nothingness in hopes of finding truth." Wanting to find truth was something Roan understood all too well. But nothingness? "What do you mean, gaze upon the nothingness?" "A hole," Yila said. "The Terrans believed their god was represented by a hole with no bottom, located in their capital city, Shai. Only the priests and priestesses were permitted to enter the hole itself, spending time communing with their god in order to reach enlightenment. To become a holy person, one first had to achieve all seven of the virtues. Patience, selflessness, generosity, Windy cleared her throat. Yila blinked, as if coming out of a trance. "Right. The point is, this infinite hole was the symbol of their faith." "The death of absence," Yila had said earlier. "What happened to the hole?" Roan asked. "According to the stories, it was filled in." "How can a bottomless pit be filled?" Windy said. "Wrong question. What matters is that it was, and the Terrans lost their faith, their will to fight, to persevere." "That's when they were enslaved by the Phoenicians," Roan said, understanding filling him even as air filled his lungs. "Exactly," Windy said. This was all interesting, but what does this have to do with me? Windy smiled thinly. "That's the right question. Why don't we have some tea, and I'll tell you." Staring at the scrawled note written on the last page of the book, anger rose in the back of Roan's throat. "You kept this from me, didn't you?" If Windy was offended by the accusation, she didn't show it, her expression nonchalant as she took a sip of her mud-like tea. Nearby, Yila busied herself unstacking and restacking books. "Answer me," Roan demanded. Windy placed her mug on the table, looked up. "Yes," she said simply. Roan shook his head, frustrated. He read the words again.
"Find absence. Find the truth. And find me."
It was signed by Bear Blackboots, the very man he'd been seeking when he'd travelled to Calip, to the Citadelian archives. A renewed sense of purpose rose within him.
"What would you have done if I'd shown you this note?" Windy asked.
Roan stared at her, chewing his lip. His anger melted like butter in a heated fry pan. He knew exactly what he would have done. In his haste to find the man he believed to be the son of the Western Oracle, he would have cast aside everything else and travelled south, finding his way onto a boat headed for Terragon. More importantly was what he wouldn't have done. "I wouldn't have gone with Raven Sands to Faria. I wouldn't have fought Bane. Gareth Ironclad would be dead." That thought brought him back to reality.
"You knew I had another purpose before I read this note," Roan said. "How?"
Windy seemed to consider the question, picking up her mug and swirling its contents around.
"I have no power, not like you."
She tapped her head.
"Only my mind and instincts. Something told me it wasn't time for you to see that book."
Roan nodded. She wasn't lying, of that he was certain.
He closed the book and gazed at the cover, running his fingers over the title, which was etched into the leather, darkened with gold ink. The Death of Absence, it was titled. A Story of Woe by the Western Oracle.
"Have you read it?" he asked.
As usual, Windy dodged his question.
"I noticed you didn't ask who Bear Blackboots is," she said instead. "You know him, don't you?"
"Yes, no, sort of. He helped save my life from a nymph queen back in the tangle. We weren't formally introduced, but I came here to find him."
"Why?"
Now Roan had the opportunity to hold something back if he chose to. He sighed. There were too many secrets in his life already. And not so long ago he'd pledged not to keep them any more.
"I believe he's the son of the Western Oracle."
If Windy was surprised by the declaration, she didn't show it. Yila, however, stopped what she was doing and said,
"The Western Oracle was executed almost 2 centuries ago. How could her son be alive?"
Roan shook his head.
"I don't know. Perhaps he is marked. Perhaps he's half-Orion. Somehow he's alive, and he can change his shape into that of a bear."
Windy licked her lips, her eyes seeming to catch fire.
"A shape-shifter? Then the northern stories are more than just legend. I've heard rumours of a man who could transform into a bear near the Mournful Mountains. I believed them to be naught but drunken gossip. But if what you say is true..."
Roan hadn't heard such rumours, nor did he care much for them.
"I still don't understand what the death of a Terran god has to do with the Western Oracle, other than the fact that she wrote a book about it."
Windy smiled, saying nothing, staring at the book. Roan gazed down, realization hitting him for the first time. This book was new. Its hardcover was in fine condition, its pages sturdy, not brittle like the countless other books he and Yila had handled while conducting their research on the Western Oracle and the origins of the Fate Marks. Either the Western Oracle was still alive, or...
"Bear Blackboots wrote this," he said.
Windy clapped her hands.
"I was thinking the same thing. Of course, at the time, I didn't know he might be the Oracle's long-lost son. That changes everything. Somehow Absence and Terragon are at the core of this story. Yila's research might hold the answers we're looking for."
Yila nodded excitedly.
"The Western Oracle, before she was known by that name, went to Terragon. Did you know that?"
"Of course he didn't," Windy said. "Even I didn't know that."
"Why?" Roan asked. "Why did she go?"
"Scholarship," Windy said with a half-smile. "The pursuit of knowledge. It seems she was a woman after my own heart."
The vision Bane had shown him came back to Roan in a rush. The Oracle's eyes rolled back, her lips moving, words, no, prophecies, flowing forth. Her son, a young Bear Blackboots, frantically writing them down under the glow of firelight.
Two sides of the same coin.
Roan closed his eyes. Knowledge. Truth. He knew where the Oracle and her son were when she had her first prophecy.
Terragon.
He told them everything, holding nothing back. Last, he told them about his dream of the Horde gathering in some distant land, of the bodies piling up.
"No more secrets," he thought when he finished.
Windy Sands leaned back in her chair and sipped her tea, saying nothing.
2. The Northern Kingdom, Castle Hill. Zelda Garrick. Zelda missed food almost as much as she missed her niece, Queen Anise Garrick. Yes, the sellswords, known as the Brotherhood, fed her each day, but stale bread and meat unfit for a dog hardly counted as a meal. Yet she ate everything they brought her anyway, washing it all down with the snow melt dripping down the dank walls of her cell. She needed to keep her strength up, because she'd come to a decision. She wouldn't wait for Anise to arrive with her armies to save her. Zelda knew she wouldn't be able to bear it if her niece perished on her account. No, Zelda would save herself.
Luckily, the arrogance of men like Severon, the sellsword leader and self-declared king of the North, would eventually provide her with an opportunity, if she was patient. It was on his orders that she was fed each day, because he wanted her alive to watch him kill Anise, or so he said. Now he approached her cell as he did each day, like clockwork, a visit he used mostly to gloat and threaten. "You're looking pale," he said, stopping before the bars. He never got close enough for her to touch him, even if she reached through the iron ingots that stood between them.
"He fears me," she thought. "Perhaps he's cleverer than he looks."
Zelda grinned like a banshee.
"He already believes me mad. I might as well act the part. And yet, even kept from the sun, dirty and haggard, my hygiene is superior to your own. I could smell you well before I saw or heard you," she said.
She knew it was unnecessary to goad him, but then again it was too much fun to resist.
"You won't speak so boldly when I cut out your tongue."
"I won't speak at all, but I will feast, if you'd be so kind as to fry it with fat and butter and serve it on a sweet roll."
He wrinkled his nose in disgust.
"I may be a sellsword, but I am no savage.
I'll feed your tongue to the dogs, not to you."
"Pity," she said.
Without warning, she rushed at the bars, slamming into them, gripping them with white-knuckled fingers. She held back a laugh when Severon flinched.
"What news of my niece?"
she hissed, flicking her tongue like a snake. Recovering nicely, he resumed his smirk.
"My spies tell me she will not come. Though she managed to defeat the Easterners, her army was largely decimated. They say the giant known as the Armored Knight died in combat with Bjorn Stonesledge, the Ironmarked. Anise, whom my sources say was in love with the man, refuses to speak to anyone or even leave her quarters."
For the first time since the conversation started, Zelda felt a pang of uncertainty.
"It cannot be," she thought. "Terin cannot be dead. And Anise would not abandon me here." "You're lying," she said.
His sharp green eyes seemed to pierce her with their stare. He pushed several stringy tendrils of black hair away from his eyes. From experience, Zelda knew it was a habit of his, even when his hair wasn't blocking his vision.
"A good sign," she thought. "Even with me behind bars, he is nervous. Already Anise must be marching on Castle Hill, regardless of what he claims. And Terin Shiri is not dead. I won't believe that until I see his corpse."
He waved her accusation away with a hand, already turning to leave.
"Think what you want. It is no matter to me. Soon you will both be dead."
"Perhaps," she thought. "But you will be too, even if it's my last act."
His long black cloak swirled around his feet as he strode away. Zelda began making plans. The next day when Severon arrived, she spoke first.
"Have you slaughtered the royal mammoth, Enhert?"
she asked. "Hungry?" he asked, a hint of delight in his raised eyebrows.
"Famished," she said. "But that's not why I asked."
"Why so serious all of a sudden? By now you'd usually have insulted me three different ways."
She turned away, pretending to let a wave of madness shudder through her.
"Too cold for insults," she said.
In reality, it was the warmest her cell had felt. Spring had well and truly arrived. When she turned back, she said,
"You think the Mammothen will give you the advantage against Anise's army, don't you?"
Severon gave nothing away with his eyes or expression, but again he pushed his long hair behind his ear.
"My guess was right."
"We already have the advantage of battle experience and skill," he said. "But, yes, I won't lie. We were hoping the beasts of war would make our victory even more decisive."
"But they won't obey you or your men,"
Zelda said.
"They will," Severon said. "We are breaking them day by day."
Despite the certainty of his words, she could sense an undercurrent of doubt. This man had little experience dealing with the massive beasts native to the north.
"Mammothins cannot be broken like horses," she thought. "It will take months," she said. "Months you do not have. Anise will not hide forever. She will regroup, and then she will come for you.
Severon's lips closed, but Zelda could almost see his teeth grinding together behind them.
What would a lady of the North know of Mamothen? Your reputation as a recluse and a madwoman would indicate you know nothing about nothing.
Zelda leapt up, jabbing a finger in the air.
Where do you think I was hiding when I avoided court? The Mamothen shed. I had few friends. The beasts were all I had.
Truth with lies. That was the way of it.
Somehow that doesn't surprise me,
Severon said.
But if you think I will let you anywhere near the Mamothen, then you underestimate me greatly. It's your choice,
she said casually, as if she couldn't care less one way or another.
But I wouldn't think you'd have anything to fear from a woman in chains.
It's not you that concerns me. The Mamothen are as strong as 100 men.
And yet they are captives too. You have them in shackles, no? Even a full-grown male won't be able to break iron manacles. It was only an offer. I can calm the Mamothen, encourage them to follow you into battle.
She left the next part unsaid, though her tone made it clear she wasn't finished.
And, in return? I might be half mad, but I'm no fool, she said. The winds are changing in the north. I can either freeze to death or build myself a fire.
Severon's eyes narrowed.
You would betray your niece in exchange for your life. Betray is a strong word. I would only be giving you the advantage. She will still likely crush you like the cockroach that you are. But I will be alive either way. Let's call it a hedge. Truth with lies.
I can't promise you freedom.
I know. I live out my days in this cell. But at least I will live.
Severon laughed, high and loud.
It's getting to you, isn't it? The fear of death. I knew it would. After all, you are naught but a woman. Even the frigid exterior of women of the North will crack eventually. My answer to you is no, but thank you for your offer. The next time I come, I will bring the Queen's head on a platter. I will have it preserved and placed next to yours on my mantle.
Zelda watched him go, licking her lips.
I've got him, she thought.
The cell door opened with a creak. Zelda had been pretending to sleep, even as heavy boots approached along the corridor. Now she opened her eyes, blinking slowly. When she saw the black-cloaked sellswords, she pretended to be surprised.
"Have you come to surrender?"
she asked. One of the men grunted out a laugh.
"Aye, and Severon wants you for his wife."
Zelda wrinkled her nose in disgust.
"Put a sack over his head, and I shall consider it."
Less amused this time, the man said,
"Up!"
But before she could comply, two other men strode forward and grabbed her under the armpits, hauling her to her feet.
"Good service,"
she muttered, her feet finding purchase on the stonework as they hurried her out of her cell and down a dimly lit corridor. The men said nothing. Zelda said,
"I'm hungry." "You can eat when you're dead," the leader said. "Worms and hard dirt are bad for digestion. A warm bowl of Mamothen stew, however."
The leader froze, turning slowly. His face, which was pocked with holes on one side and slick with smooth skin on the other, pressed close to hers. She didn't move, her eyes holding his. After a brief stalemate, he coughed out a laugh and continued onward faster. Zelda pretended to be breathing heavily when they reached the top of the staircase, emerging into an atrium filled with bright white sunlight.
"Some warrior,"
the man scoffed as she bent over to catch her breath.
"The men they say you killed probably tripped and fell on their own swords."
"How did you know?"
Zelda said. The man rolled his eyes and gestured her to follow. He went in exactly the direction she expected. Outside, toward the Mamothen shed.
"Where is Severon?"
she asked casually.
"It's none of your concern."
"Using his chamber pot, then?"
To his credit, the sellsword ignored her. No small feat. Zelda was a hard woman to ignore. Zelda breathed in the fresh air. It wasn't warm, exactly, but not cold either, at least not by northern standards. Most of the snow had melted, and what little hadn't had been pushed up against the sides of the castle's inner walls. Members of the Brotherhood, wearing black cloaks, moved here and there on various errands. They all carried weapons. Zelda squinted against the bright sunlight and craned her gaze toward the top of the main wall. The white stone blocks reflected the spring rays like window panes. Ah, Zelda thought. At least a dozen men were positioned atop the ramparts, dutifully looking outward. It was far too many men for a castle that didn't expect to be attacked.
Anise is coming, Zelda thought. Severon lied, just as I thought.
She would have to work quickly. She turned her attention forward once more, where the humourless sellsword had stopped before a large stone structure. It was shaped like an archway, except it went on and on for a great distance, the curving roof high enough for 10 full-grown men stacked on each other's shoulders to pass through unfettered. A massive wooden door held together by thick iron fittings barred their way forward. Shouts, thudding boots, and other more animal-like sounds arose from within.
"Time to earn your keep," the man said.
With a groan, the door began to open. Zelda had to hold back a laugh as she watched the commotion within the mammothin shed. Men dove out of the way as one of the beasts swung its great trunk around like a whip. In fact, if there were barbs at the end of it, it would have resembled Taryn Sheeri's Morning Star. One man, who held a real whip, was a hair too slow. He was knocked aside like a straw doll, rolling twice before smashing into a wooden barrel filled with water, which sloshed over the sides and onto his head. With a quickness that belied its sheer size, the mammothen bucked forward, aiming one of its deadly curling tusks toward the dazed man. Chains clanked, and the beast bellowed, as it reached the end of its tether mere inches from its target. Gasping, the man shrieked,
"Get it away from me!"
His voice higher pitched than most women Zelda knew. She pretended to cough to cover her amusement.
"Fool," the sellsword said to his comrade. "Just move to the side. It can't reach you."
His eyes wide, the man obeyed, stumbling back rapidly once he was clear of the barrel.
"It's not an it, you dolt,"
Zelda wanted to shout. This one was a she, a proud lady named Murga. Mammothen were a rare species where the females were much larger than the males. Instead of berating these fool men, however, Zelda whistled high and clear. The mammothen, which had continued straining against her chains, froze. Slowly, Murga moved backwards one step at a time, before easing down onto her enormous legs, looking bored. The sellsword spun to face Zelda, while the other men openly gawked in her direction.
"Can you teach us that?"
he asked. She shook her head.
"It would take many years to perfect the pitch of each whistle command. But I can show you hand signals and convince her to obey you." "Do it," the man said, sounding desperate for the first time. "How do I know Severon will spare my life in return?"
In truth, Zelda didn't care one way or the other, but she had to continue to play her part.
"Would you like a piece of paper with the Brotherhood seal?"
the man asked, his eyes twinkling with amusement.
"Who will uphold the contract? You'll just have to trust Severon to keep his word."
Zelda nodded, while inside she was thinking,
"I'd rather trust a snake in my bed."
Not that it mattered. Chaos was coming, and she and the mammothen herd would be its flag bearers.
3. The Northern Kingdom, Gearhead. Anise Gehrig.
"Have you ever heard of this Calypsian poet, Japati?" Anise asked.
Taryn stretched and yawned, rolling over and almost knocking her out of bed. His strong hand grabbed her waist and pulled her back. The book she'd been flipping through fell from her fingers and thudded to the floor.
"Was he the guy who wrote about death a lot?"
His hands were roving now, exploring.
"I don't think so," Anise said breathlessly.
"Then no,"
Taryn said, his lips finding hers. His tongue parted them, slipping deftly inside. For several long moments, Anise forgot about Japati the poet, forgot about how her Aunt Zelda was a prisoner in her own castle, forgot about war and pain and regret. The moment passed when there was a knock on the door. Taryn broke off the kiss and sighed.
"Go away," he said.
Anise snorted out a laugh. Sir Dietrich's deep voice penetrated the wood.
"I wish I could, but a stream has just arrived from Castle Hill."
Anise closed her eyes.
"What does it say?"
She held her breath. Taryn gripped her hand firmly, comfortingly.
"It's a request for surrender."
Anise said nothing, waiting for the rest, unspoken words hovering like dark crows.
"Lady Zelda will be executed if you do not."
Anise's breath rushed out. Taryn's teeth ground together.
"I'll kill every one of the Brotherhood," he said.
There was a dangerous edge to his voice, one that turned his threat into a promise. The line between Taryn and the monster inside him seemed to grow ever thinner. His body jolted, as if he'd just recognized her reaction to his words, however subtle.
I
know, she said.
"You just want to protect me, to protect Zelda. You are a good man, Taryn Shiri."
He frowned, his expression disjointed to the words she'd just spoken. She could see the doubt.
"He still fears himself," she thought.
Anise wondered if he always would.
"Thank you, Dietrich," she said loudly. "We shall be out shortly."
Taryn opened his mouth to speak again, but Anise silenced him with a kiss. When she pulled away, her hands moved up to hold his chin. Her thumbs traced circles on his pale, too smooth skin, marred only by the dark, raised veins curling like asps from chin to temples.
"Don't you dare leave me," she said. "Never again."
Though he'd already promised her he wouldn't, she needed to hear it again. Needed it like she needed air, like the north needed sunshine.
"I won't. Not ever."
She raised his hand to her lips and kissed each knuckle, one at a time. Then she crawled out of bed and began to pull on her armor. She was thinking about Japati. It was sad that a man who wrote such beautiful words believed love held no place in life. Anise was determined to prove him wrong. It was the strangest army Anise had ever seen, and yet, to her eyes, it was the perfect army. On one side stood Sir Christoph Metz, his silver armor gleaming under the blazing spring sun. Behind him stood his female army, the first in northern history, a group of stalwart women who'd heard Anise's call and volunteered to join her cause. They were the best of the north, proof that there was still some good to be had in this place of ice and snow. On the opposite side, but well apart from the others, stood the strange girl known as Lisbeth Lorne, her unseeing eyes glazed with white film. She wore a blue silk dress that brushed the ground around her feet. Around her were the sleeping knights, though the name hardly seemed appropriate any more. Anise didn't think they ever slept. In the dead center was Taryn, his white armor the color of fresh snow, with the few men who remained in his company, a ragtag assortment of castaways from Darin. Nearby stood Fay, the blacksmith who'd designed his new set of armor, thick, heavy plates, that none but the armored knight could wear. When Anise met Fay's gaze, she nodded. Anise nodded back. Beside her, Jonius's age-wrinkled eyes met hers in the manner that only an old friend could. With solidarity, with trust. The trust had taken them a long time to achieve, but finally, there were no secrets between them. Sir Dietrich cleared his throat. Anise met his gaze, and something about it buoyed her up. Yes, they'd had their disagreements, not the least of which was his unwillingness to talk about his sword mark, hidden on his back behind a burn scar, but he was still her unflinching ally, as all these good people were. On another side stood Archer, and he nodded to her to begin. They'd discussed what to do together, not as queen and prince, but as sister and brother, as friends and advocates. At one time the throne had been his, but there was no grudge in his heart now, if there ever was. A swell of pride rolled through her. A queen should be so lucky to stand with warriors of this quality.
"I am lucky."
And yet, Zelda's life was in her hands. She could save it by surrendering. In doing so, she would let down each and every one of those standing before her, waiting for her to speak.
"By now, I'm sure you've all heard the news," she said.
Heads bobbed, hands went to hilts, jaws tensed. She refused to meet Terin's eyes, which she knew would be burning like lit coals. This was a decision to be made with cool heads,